Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to another edition of our new semi-regular show, The Interviews, which collects the most interesting cinema-related chats we've been having recently in one handy place. We're starting off this week with the two stars of the excellent, hard-hitting British prison drama Waste Man. They are, of course, the wonderful David Johnson, who plays a young man called Taylor, who is on the verge of parole, and Tom Blythe as Dee, a new cellmate whose volatility may jeopardise Taylor's impending freedom. Cal McMaul's debut film is an eye-opening look at the British penal system and also an incredibly tense thriller. Shawshank, it ain't. I caught up with Johnson and Blythe on Zoom yesterday, Thursday, for a really interesting conversation about prisons, reform, no-holds-barred auditions, acting in a tiny cell, and more. Really enjoyed this one. Hope you do too. Enjoy. Jesus Christ, this film. I mean, it is extraordinary. It is a tough sit, a tough watch, but I think it's a very, very important movie at this point in time. Is that kind of how it lodged it in your minds as well?
It's funny, isn't it? It's like when you read a script at first, you kind of don't. I speak for myself. You don't think about like the wider implications of what it might mean, you know, societally or politically or just in the community. You just kind of go like, is this something that excites me? Is it a part I haven't played before? Is it something that's going to stretch me? And then when you're making it, and especially once you see it, you realize the impact it can have. And that's been the case for me. I think I just fell in love with the script as a script and the character as a character. And then having seen it now, I'm like, wow, this is a meaningful film. It can and will hopefully change some lives. So that's just like the cherry on top, you know?
Yeah,
absolutely. David, what about yourself?
No, you only hope, don't you? You only hope that this film can do something bigger than entertain. I mean, I believe this film has always been a freedom ride from the script. You know, I came in contact with the script quite a long time ago, actually, and had a read of it and thought it was brilliant. But I think that what you hope is that there's something bigger here. And I think when we were filming it, we can feel it. And I think when we just, you know, as we started to do the prep process, we can feel it. And now we've kind of got something that I think I'll speak for everyone when I say we're quite proud of this film. We're proud of that we made a film about people. We made a film about society. And beyond that, you know, everything else you get for free. So I think we're very proud of this movie.
It is a movie that, from my point of view, just made me really despondent about the prison system in this country. People don't have a chance in this system. Has it made you feel similarly, or you know, what were your feelings on the penal system in this country before you started, and did those change over time?
I mean, most of my exposure to it comes from documentaries, films, TV. I've known a few people who have done it in their time. But even that, like, you don't really ask questions because you don't want to pry. You know, like, it's just generally like the culture of that thing that you don't ask someone unless they offer it up, right? But to then delve into it in such a deep way, we kind of did have to do some like documentary kind of investigation of our own. And it is probably the most I've ever delved into anything, really, because it is such a specific subculture in itself. I think I've come away with a two-part feeling about the process, which was everyone we've spoken to who is involved in either like Switchback in the charity and Prison Leavers, or people who have been inside themselves. Every person who's seen it has said how real it feels, which is this double-edged sword, because you go, oh, I'm glad we did it justice. I'm glad we told your story truthfully. But then you look at the story of Dee and Taylor and how tragic and violent and problematic it is, and you go, I wish it wasn't. Like, I wish what we'd done wasn't real, in a way. Because the reality of that is that real people are being affected and like having their lives worsened instead of actual rehabilitation happening.
Yeah, it's so hard, isn't it? Because I think our film, I really don't think it poses any answers. I don't think it gives any accusations. I think it only,
there's no judgments necessarily.
No judgment, honestly, there isn't, and that's okay. Some films can do that, and sometimes that's entertaining. That's awesome, but that's not what our film does. I think it's just questions. Like, I think about my mum was a police officer for 10 years, and yeah, she'd come home and tell me stories about, you know, this person, that young person who had it all ahead of them, and they're throwing it away. And then kind of doing this movie, you kind of see like, oh God, like it's really hard on both sides. Like I even think about some of the officers that play, you know, our custodian, shall we say, in the movie, and I'm like, bloody hell, they're overworked.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's a really I think it's just nice that we were able to shine a light, hopefully with Zero Judgment. I like those films that make you think, mm-hmm. and make you just go, what can life be? What is life? What are we putting our taxes towards? Because that's what it is. We're all contributing to it. So I just think it's worth the conversation.
I think I'm so much more interested in films that pose questions instead of posing answers, because I actually don't think it's the job of, like, I always think storyteller is such a wanky title, but like, it's, you know, for this purposes of this conversation, storytellers and artists and people who make film and TV, I don't necessarily think it's our job to try and get on a pedestal and tell people how to fix things. Like, that's what we pay taxes to elected officials for.
Mm.
But I do think it is our job to hold a mirror up and ask questions and go, I think we have a problem.
Mm.
Here's what it is. We're going to shine a light on it. And then you open a discussion and then we all get to decide as a society how you fix it, I think, right?
Totally, totally.
Yeah.
But that's not why you got into it. You got into it because this is an extraordinarily compelling story and these are incredible characters. And David, you mentioned there that your first encounter with this movie was a few years ago now, because you auditioned years ago for this movie. Back when, and you auditioned for D, right?
Dude, yeah, back in the day. Yeah, back in the day. And by the way,
how was my job?
Jesus Christ. No, yeah. Do you know what? Yeah, no, he's back to being D again, by the way. Oh yeah, I did. You know, I mean, I got my girlfriend at the time to draw like a tattoo on my neck, and I went off into this room and with the casting director, and I thought, you know, we kind of came to blows, and I thought I nailed it. I did a really good job, and then I heard nothing.
And so I have got to interrogate that first of all before you go on. Sorry, you came to blows with the casting director?
Yeah, it was. Do you know what? So, sometimes you've got to, haven't you? Am I the only one? Do you know what? I'm not gonna lie, it was a very heated audition. And by the way, it actually holds part true to what this film, the film that we end up making. It's a, you know, it was very just, we had to remain true in whatever it was. So it's all about just being the real person. So anyway, I tried my best to do that, and then I heard nothing. So I don't know if I even did a good job. But what happened was the film just fell apart. You know, I always say making movies is like really hard. And on even talking to you now on this film podcast, it's, you guys know more than anything, every movie that gets made like deserves a medal, because it's heroic act of like community and, you know, and perseverance. Anyway, the film kind of came back round, and obviously the second that I started to gain maybe a little bit of urgency, you chase the projects that feel like they meant something to you. And then when Cal and I met up again, we looked at it from an entirely different perspective, and I thought, and he said, I think you should play Taylor. I think it would be a different, you know, he wanted, the character's actually meant to be much more older than me. But I thought in the same way, like, you know, like films like After Sun, the reason why it was so much more urgent is because it was a younger man, like, trying to take care of his daughter. And I thought that couldn't be applicable here. So we did that. And then we found the missing piece, which is the Tom. Because no one could do D like Tom did D. Do you know what I mean? And my one would have been all right. But
yeah, how are you doing D, by the way? Was it different from Tom?
Hey, do you know what? That'll be my next movie. Just tune in.
Yeah.
You'll see that.
It just becomes a D.
Exactly.
So if you can't beat him, join him.
Tom, how did you get involved in? And did you throw a chair at the casting director or come to fisticuffs with anyone?
I do have a story about that particular casting director, but that's for a different day.
There we go.
Okay.
Reminded me of that.
Who's this casting director? Reggie Cray? What's going on?
Yeah. One of the Cray twins.
He shall not be named.
He shall not be named. He's actually.
I can look it up.
They're a lovely casting director, but have a colourful colourful history.
That's
They're known for being like, for getting a good performance out of you by throwing objects at you. I just had a meeting. I had a meeting with Cal and Sophia. Quite a while ago, when it was first, or maybe not first, but kind of starting to try and get off the ground. Mm. And then I didn't hear anything for a while. And then out of nowhere, I was in the middle of filming this other film, Plain Clothes. And Cal came back like a year and a half later and said, we never ended up making that film. We'd still love to kind of have a chat with you about it. And we had a meeting, and it kind of transpired that he had some doubts about whether or not I had D in me. And I later learned that David had been like, look, I know him, I know who he is inside and what he can bring, and kind of tried to convince Cal, and Cal luckily took the meeting, and I was able to tell him about kind of my interpretation of D, and that I know this person personally, and I grew up with D's, and I think he just hadn't seen it in my body of work yet, because I was playing people who were probably further from me than this. And kind of had a bit of convincing to do, I think, which I now in hindsight realize. We got greenlit really last minute, and it really quickly all came together at the kind of final hurdle. We had like 3 weeks to prepare really to get into it. And so we kind of hustled.
Wow. I mean, I think that sense of urgency comes across in the film, but David, by the way, I believe when Cal was talking to you about Tom, you said he's an actor, let him act.
Exactly what I said. You know, it's the hardest thing, because I mean, first of all, Tom is first and foremost my mate, so I'm going to campaign for him no matter where I am, but he doesn't really need it because he's an actor. It's the hardest thing about being an actor, and I use that with like an actor with a capital A. It's like, you spend your life trying to, like, I don't know, we're young actors, but we're trying to make a body of work for ourselves. But sometimes what happens is, because you go so far away to different places, people go, well, I don't know if they can do that. And you're like, well, hang on. I spent all my time showing you that I can go to that place and that place. What makes you think I can't get to there? It's a bit of my pet peeve about this industry sometimes. It's almost like they want you to be the person as the person. I'm like, well, that's not really acting.
And it seems to be more that way, like getting more and more. And I think because of so much bloody reality TV and stuff, it feels like, and everyone's got access to everyone online. I think people are almost just, they forget that they're like, what we do for a living is actually, when it's done right, and what we're hopefully trying to do is like athletic. Like,
totally.
It's like, and it's a stretch. Like you're supposed to be trying to like, see how big your empathy muscle is to try and stretch and become other people. We talk about this all the time.
All the time. By the way, this is all to say, we do love some reality TV. Tom and I have been talking a lot about this particular show, which we'll leave right now if you don't want to do too much product placement. But but yeah, anyway.
Okay, all right. I could throw some names, but I won't. But yeah, it's fascinating because when you get to it, when you're on set making the movie, a lot of your scenes are in that really cramped cell. And how do you start navigating that space together? And does that inform your performances, that idea of being shut in by this really, really claustrophobic cell?
I think it's the perks of, you know, I'm careful when I say this because you know, obviously we want to do big movies sometimes. Sometimes we want to do this, but this particular scenario, it's the perks of not really having too much. Like, we have no time really to prep. You know, we had a very small budget, a modest budget, shall we say, but we had everyone around us who wanted to make the best movie possible. So a restriction, like a tiny cell, became like our biggest asset. So we were like, Lorenzo, our DP, who's just bloody amazing, you know, he would be like thinking about this shot and squeezing as tight as he could in this corner so we can get Tom, you know, doing something mad or whatever it was. And it was like, because that's the reality, right? These guys actually do live in these tiny cells, so we're not going to try and make it, you know, something else. I think our restriction actually became like our playground. We were like, all right, let's see what we can do in this tight space and for the days and the time that we had. You know, sometimes we shot like 7 scenes in a day. Do you know what I mean? It was like, there was just no time, which meant that Tom and I were always on, always prepared. I think we stayed in it the whole time. And then once the cameras would be able to cut and that's the wrap on the day, Tom and I would be like, right, let's go and have a pint. You know what I mean? Because we've done our day's work. So yeah, man, I actually quite liked it.
Yeah, I'm generally, and I think the same for you, I'm generally not a method actor, in quotes, whatever that even means. It's been bastardized a little bit, but I generally don't feel the need to stay in character all day, every day. I kind of pick and choose when, but this, I think because of the nature of the limitations and how quick we had to move, and the fact that we were like hopping in and out real quick, and sometimes we had like 20 minutes to get a scene and we just went handheld and run and gunned it. I stayed in a lot, you stayed in a lot, and actually for the majority of the 4 weeks we were shooting, both of us stayed in character. And it was a fascinating experiment, because I actually think the boundaries and the limitations and how kind of little we had to work with spatially and time wise actually made us work in a different way that was really exciting, because we had to. It wasn't a creative woo-woo choice. It was like, we actually have to, just so that we're not wasting time, right? We have to stay in character so that we're always ready. Which for me, I was like, oh, that's opening up a new way of working, which I like.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting as well, because again, you know, I think you're obviously right. Method acting has been, the concept of it's been a bit bastardized, and people's understanding of it is, I think, fairly basic these days. Yeah. So I'm not suggesting for a second that when you were in character as D, you were violent and combustible. But did that make you different to be around a little bit? Because you guys are mates. But were you able to be matey with each other in that moment, given the antagonism between the characters?
It's funny. I feel like at the start of the day, we'd come in and we'd be all pally for 5 minutes, and then we go into our little tiny trailers, get ready, come out in costume, and then almost wouldn't be David and Tom for the rest of the day.
Yeah.
But then on the final wrap of the day, we go in, take our makeup off, well, the tattoos stayed on for the whole time, but take our bruises and our, you know, our costumes off, and then we'd be David and Tom again.
Yeah.
And it was this really weird but really quite fun experiment in kind of doing like partial, I hate the word method because it just means so many different things, but like,
yeah,
method acting, in the sense that we were staying in it for a lot of the day, and then we got to debrief at the end of the day.
Do you know what I think as well? I think a lot of the time as actors, you get asked to do something, and you find, you talk to the director, you meet the team, and then you find yourself on set, and sometimes you're meeting your co-star for the first time on the day or in rehearsals. You're like sussing them out. And they're kind of sussing you out. You're like, how far can I actually push this? And sometimes I don't ask that question, and sometimes I do, because I don't want to be mean. You know what I mean? I want to make sure we're both getting the scene, and I look good if you look good, right? But the wonderful thing about our film is that Tom and I had that trust.
Mm.
So it meant that when he needed to go and do whatever he needed to do, I don't think he needed to ask me permission. He wasn't trying to suss me out. So it meant that he can like quite literally swing from the bars, and I'll be fine with it. In fact, I embrace it. Do you know what I mean? So I think that really helps making our movie. Like, yeah. So just basically, I just want to work with my mates.
And Cal gave his permission as well, didn't he? Like, Cal encouraged it. I don't know what he said to you, but to me, he was like, go for it. He said, I want you to come in. I don't want you to torment the crew, but I want the air in the room when you come in to feel like nobody quite knows what's going to happen.
Mm.
He was like, I want it to feel like slightly on the edge, like on a knife's edge, which the first few days was hard, because you are getting to know the crew. Me and David like knew each other, but we're getting to know each other more.
Mm.
And very quickly you suss out that, oh, they've like, me and David work the same way, have the same MO. The crew is like here for the right reasons. So they want to see like exciting shit happen. And so, yeah, permission was given. And I think we both took it and ran with it. And it created a really like, a lot of friction on set in a good way, in a healthy, exciting way.
On that note, David, Tom, thanks very much indeed.
Chris, thank you so much. A pleasure as always.
Okay, that was Tom Blythe and David Johnson talking about Waste Man, which is in cinemas right now. We gave it 4 stars. Well deserved. Go along and check it out. Also in cinemas right now is Gore Verbinski's first film in a while. Good luck. Have fun. Don't die. It's a genre-bending flick that sees Sam Rockwell claim to be a time traveller from the future who must recruit a motley crew from a diner with one simple goal: to save the world from an impending AI apocalypse. One of the crew that Rockwell recruits is Scott, played by the excellent Assam Chowdhury, best known for his role as Chabadi G in People Just Do Nothing. I caught up with Assam on Zoom yesterday. It was a busy day yesterday. And we talked about AI, working with Rockwell, Assam's time on Taskmaster, group chats, and more. Ton of fun, this one. Enjoy. Assam Chowdhury, welcome to the Ampro Podcast. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. You drinking water at the moment? So you're lifting the water to your lips?
A little espresso.
Espresso. Because it's 3:30 in the afternoon, you need that sort of punch to get you through the rest of the day.
Exactly. I think I'm on my third one, but it's all good. It's all good, you know? It's all fuel for the machine.
It's all grist for the mill. Grist for the mill. So good luck. Have fun. Don't die is out this week. It's an absolute mindfuck of a movie. What was the screenplay
that, Chris,
like?
Just saying, actually, that's a great word to start on, mindfuck, because when we were watching the film in Germany, obviously, at that for the film festival, they had German subtitles on, and that's how I learned that mindfuck in English, it means the same, it's the same in German. It translates to mindfuck. And Zazie Beetz, who's American-German, I confirmed it with her as well. So that's, you learn something new every day. So mindfuck, which, you know, it sounds German anyway, but I mean, you know. Yeah.
Mindfuck. Maybe it is the original German. Who knows?
It could be. But yeah, I think mindfuck is a great word for it. Yeah, it is a bit of a mindfuck. It's out there. It's definitely out there.
It is out there. And was the script, when you read it for the first time, you know, was that a mindfuck for you? You know, figuring out what the hell is going on and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, Matthew Robinson, the writer, who I have to say is a brilliant writer and even more brilliant person, he is a real British comedy connoisseur. So most of our, when we were out in Cape Town filming it, most of our chats were around British comedy, around The Office and, you know, Spinal Tap. I mean, I know Spinal Tap's all British comedy, but you know what I mean? That mockumentary, Peep Show, you know, then obviously, you know, he started watching People Just Do Nothing when we were out there, and he was like, oh my God, dude. But he's a real, really good writer. I always do a kind of 10-page test on a script when I get a script. You know, give it 10 pages. If it hasn't hooked you in, then, or, you know, it doesn't even have to be hooky. Just like, what's the writing like? What are the characters like? I knew Sam Rockwell was playing the man from the future. So for the first 10 minutes of that film, that brilliant monologue, I just pictured Sam Rockwell, you know, one of the greats, doing that. And then I thought, fucking hell, this is Gore Verbinski. You know, the set piece design, the direction is going to be bonkers. And then with the sharp writing, I thought, I have to be in, you know, like, this is an honor. So yeah, really good script, very ambitious, but I think they pulled it off. You know, I'm quite proud of the film.
I'm guessing in the first 10 pages of Matthew's script, nobody else speaks, really, apart from Sam, because it's just, he's going at it hell for leather from the minute he gets on screen. And your character, Scott, is a passive observer in this diner at this point, going, what the hell is this guy on? So were you thinking, all right, I'm in just because this monologue's too good? Or were you waiting, did you then read another 10 pages to see how Scott turned out before you went, yes?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, for the first 10 pages, I was kind of in already, because I thought it's got some, you know, brilliant commentary on AI and what's happening to our world within the first 10 minutes. But it's done in a way that's not preachy. It's done in a way that, you know, a little bit of sugar helps the medicine go down. So I think it's, you know, and then obviously you close your eyes and you think of Sam Rockwell doing that and you think, bloody hell, it's going to be, you know, it kind of gives me the energy of like Beetlejuice, kind of mixed with, you know, Rick and Morty. He's got that. It was that energy. Just watching him do it in person, absolutely unbelievable. And I tell you what, you know, they say don't meet your heroes. Meet Sam Rockwell if you get a chance. An absolutely wonderful man. So talented, so humble. You know, he's always known for playing kind of supporting actors, right? And being, you know, and stealing every scene. But yeah, it was an honor to watch him lead us, because he really was our leader. Him and Gore, you know, they really led us. So yeah, I mean, those first 10 pages, unbelievable. And it was just an honor to watch a master at work, really, because, you know, sometimes I moan if I've got a 2 or 3 page scene, you know, I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake. This guy's doing, you know, 10, 11 pages flawlessly. And not just that, you know, Gore Verbinski, I truly believe, is one of the greatest set piece directors of our time. I mean, obviously this man did Pirates of the Caribbean and the best ones as well. Every single thing is timed. Every single detail is intentional. And, you know, it was a joy just watching Gore as well. And he already saw the movie in his head. You know, he was one of those kind of directors. So yeah, really impressive. I learned a lot. You know, I mean, like I said, my character, I'm there along for the ride. You know, he's not one of the, you know, leads or anything, even though I think I've got some good stuff and then I'm proud of it. But I was there to learn, you know, as a youngish actor, filmmaker myself, who's, you know, there's some real Hollywood heavyweights there. And I learned and I soaked it all in. And now I'm friends with these people and I can call on them for things and ask them for advice. It was an honor just watching these fucking brilliant people work.
When was the last time you called one of them for advice?
You know what? So we've got a group chat, mm-hmm. and so when we were out there in Cape Town, we actually we all got food poisoning around the same time. So you know, so we kind of trauma bonded on that, and for a long time we called this movie "Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Diarrhea." So that is the name of our group chat, and the group chat. You know what it's like. You know when you work with people, and then you know you have a good time, and then you make a group chat. The group chat's dead within a few months, right? Yeah. You know, this one, I mean, you know, we did it around 2 years ago. The group chat's popping. I mean, Sam Rockwell's sending GIFs. You know, we're sending silly pictures. I mean, throughout 2 years, it's been pretty consistent. So, I can call upon them anytime now. I think we really bonded. I think it was just and the girls as well, fantastic. You know, Zazie, Haley, and Juno, they really got along like sisters, you know. Then it was me, Michael, Sam, the kind of boys. And it was just a great mixture. And I think you can tell that, you know, even when, if you look at press pictures from us at Berlin, we're being so stupid and we're having the time of our lives. And, you know, I think you can always tell that on screen when people do really get on. It's just, you know, people are happy to work with each other and they're, you know, so a real, really, really great bunch of people. And hopefully people that we stay in touch with and work with in the future. Yeah, good vibes.
So when you knew you were coming on the show, did you text the group chat going, "Should I do the Empire podcast, guys?" And they were like, "Fuck no."
They were like, "Mind fuck."
mind fuck no.
No, I'm the only UK representative. So I spoke to Gore last week, and obviously, you know what it's like at these film festivals. It's a lot of drinking, a lot of eating, a lot of indulgence. So every night we'd go back to the hotel. And we'll be in the cigar lounge, me, Sam, Gore, Zazie, everyone. And Gore will be kind of talking about, because Gore's really into like British comedy and People Just Nothing. And he was quite intrigued about how we did marketing for People Just Nothing. And I told him, you know, we stayed in character for years and we did all these different things. And we had in character social medias that everyone thought was real, you know, very different. But he was like, "Man," he goes, "you're going to sell this movie for me in the UK because I'm the only one here." Because Juno's in LA. So I was like, "Gore, for you, I'll do it, mate." So, but also, Empire Podcast, that's, you know, you can't say no to you guys. I mean, come on.
You can. And many have asked him and should, to be honest, going forward as well. How many group chats do you have? Is there a Taskmaster group chat?
No, there isn't. Because I think Taskmaster, when I did it, it was a long time ago, first of all. You know, it was when it was on Dave. My Taskmaster group, I wouldn't say we were like best mates. I felt like we were so different, all of us. Like, you would never, ever catch us in the same. Maybe me and Russell, because we're both comedians, like, you know, traditional comedians. You know, I mean, Tim Vine, amazing guy, very weird in the most wonderful way. Lisa is always bonkers. Alex, very quirky. So no, we didn't have a group chat, but we got on. But I wouldn't say. Also, it's weird with Taskmaster because you do all your tasks on your own,
right?
And then you do some together, and then you do the studio stuff, which is like really rushes two shows a day for five days,
three hour records as well, right?
Yeah.
But so you're probably sick of each other by the time you do that.
No, you know what? I think it happens so quick, you don't even have time to process stuff. You know, it's so they kind of bang it out. But no, I love doing Taskmaster. It was great. I think our season is very underrated. I think it goes under the radar, our season.
Yeah, go rewatch season 6, isn't it? Yours?
Yeah.
Yours?
Yeah.
So go rewatch it.
Underrated one, yeah.
What other group chats do you have then?
I mean, I do hate group chats. I'm not a big fan of group chats, you know.
You just said you had loads.
Yeah, I do, but it's, I mean, I have one, I'm just having a look now. I have one, let's have a look. I mean, obviously you have group chats for different friendship groups, but I'm trying to think like in particular work ones. I have had some, I mean, I've got a Cropped FM one, obviously, with the People Just Do Nothing boys, and their names are all saved in character because I remember during lockdown, I had to record this WhatsApp phone conversation for Comic Relief. And so they are still just on my phone as Decoy, Beats, Grinder. I just never changed it. Steve's. You know, I don't like them. I don't like group. I don't like texting in general. You know, going on this whole technology thing, like I'm very much I will tell you when I see you in person. You know, I don't like texting too much. I'm not a big phone call guy. Like, I'm a very IRL, in real life, you know, real life person.
Where do you stand on AI? Do you use Do you use it at all to make your life easier?
You know what I do? I do use it, but I don't use it for anything that kind of, any kind of thing that it requires the human soul. So anything like creative or anything medical, like I've been telling my wife to get the fuck off ChatGPT when it comes to medical stuff, because it's so bad. Because it's not real medical advice. It's just a collection of Google data, you know, that.
Yeah.
And then the way that the AI tells you it is so sophisticated, like it's fact, and it's not, you know, it's not. Your AI can gaslight you. I don't really trust it. And I think it's getting dumber. You know, people say, oh, it's getting better. I actually think it's getting dumber. I think there's so many mistakes it makes. I think it's overloaded. I think it's terrible for the environment, which we know it is, but there are some pros for it. Like, I think, you know, the fact that it can go through a, you know, 20,000 page document and, you know, find certain things that might take you hours. It can also be great for medical research. I'm all for that kind of stuff, right? Making the kind of mundane stuff that will take us ages, you know, things that it can do very quickly. I'm all for that. But yeah, when it comes to anything to do with the soul, I think it's really bad. I think it's rubbish because it can't create anything new. It just deals with its existing data. So there's no original thought from AI, you know? So yeah, I am. I think as I'm getting older and older, I'm more against it because sometimes I see treatments sent to me and they're all AI and I'm like, fuck this. I'm not doing this. Like you couldn't even, you know, it's just lazy. It's so lazy. And technology in general, like, I mean, I love my tech. Don't get me wrong. I'm a real tech head. But I also think, man, as I get older, I want to just connect with real things and real people, you know, and it's getting harder and harder. So I think this film is a really good anti-AI film. It's got good messaging about it. I mean, in a dark way, like I said, about, you know, done in an entertaining way as well, but it is pretty dark as well.
Do you worry about AI in a terms of existential way? Not just the idea that one day we might all die at the hands of some sort of Skynet thing, or are you worried as well, like in a career way? Because I think a lot of people have been talking about this advance of AI recently and how quickly scripts can be generated and how one day, maybe not too far from now, we might be able to be at the point where someone can come home, turn on their TV, go, I want a new, brand new episode of People Just Do Nothing, and it makes it, and you have no input whatsoever, and it's there. Does that terrify you? Because it scares the shit out of me.
Yeah, that's a very scary thought. I mean, I would say I think the creative prompts are so bad right now, even though, like, technically they look good. Like, technically the visuals look incredible and even my voiceover agent, like, I think a couple of years ago, they said, we just want to let you know that, you know, we found some Chobuddy G clone voices online. You know, like, because, you know, you can clone a voice, you can train an AI to clone your voice. And they were saying that, you know, we are keeping an eye out for it. And if we need to, we'll press legal action. I think it needs to come down into regulations and law. I think that's what's going to have to happen. But I still don't think it's ever going to be, like you just said, make me a new episode of People Just Nothing. Make me a new episode of Sopranos. It's going to be shit. Like, I'm telling you. It will be shit. Even when you look at, like, the best AI right now, like the stuff that's not even commercially available, and you look at it, yes, it will look great technically, the lighting, but actually it will be shit. Like the content will be shit, the story will be shit, the acting will be shit, everything will be shit. So it's no soul. There's no soul. So I really hope that never happens, but you never know, man. I think we'd have to protect ourselves with laws and safeguarding in some way, because, you know, it can happen. I mean, the rate is what it's like. If you look to AI, what is it, the famous Will Smith spaghetti thing, right?
Yeah,
if you look at that, where what that was like 5 years ago, it looked terrible, and now it looks insane. So it's just about doing your own research as well, you know. It's about, you know, checking sources and everything, and people don't want to do that. People just want to be presented with something and then take that as fact.
Yeah, and we won't know what's real and what's not, and it's crazy. I don't know that you are you right now, to be honest. So you could be AI.
Exactly. I could be Omid Jalili, for all you know.
Well, hey, you can't spell Asim without AI. I'm just going to throw it out there.
Oh, God, here we go. Here we bloody go.
Here we go. Here's the conspiracy.
I've also got Arse in my name, so I don't know what that means. I mean, take of that what you will.
Let's not go there. I've got to go in a second, but okay. That opening 10 minutes, when you guys are in the diner, how long did that take? Because Gore's got to cover all sorts of angles as well, right?
Yeah, it took a long time. I think around probably 4 or 5 days, I think we were on that scene. It took a long time. And yeah, Sam was unbelievable. And we did that first up as well to get that out of the way. And Sam's suit was a really, really tricky thing for him as well. He was boiling in it. He actually had a cooling system installed into his suit. He was like a fucking high-end PC. It was ridiculous. But yeah, what a trooper, man. You know, well, I mean, he probably had to get naked to take a shit. You know what I mean? It was one of those kind of costumes.
Don't we all?
Yeah. Oh, sorry. You know, actually, that's a thing, though. People do that because they're like, oh, I don't want to get any kind of poo smell on my clothes. And I'm like, what? So you get fully naked? That was one of my mates did that. I was like, that's fucking weird, mate. All kudos to Sam Rockwell, the legend himself. An absolute lovely man. Yeah, like I said, meet your heroes if it's Sam Rockwell.
Okay, that was Asim Chowdhury talking about Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die, which is in cinemas now. Our third and final guest this week doesn't have a film to plug, although he's plugged a few in his time, if you know what I mean. I mean, plug as in kill, as in he's killed a few in his time. With his words. He's killed a few in his time with his words because he is the legendary American film critic Leonard Maltin, and he has a new book out called Every Movie is a Miracle, which is essentially a long conversation between Maltin and his friend Nat Segeloff. And it's well worth your time, folks. I jumped onto Zoom with Maltin, who is the author also of the legendary Leonard Maltin's Movie Guide, and is a man who probably rivals our own Kim Newman for films seen in his lifetime. Oh, and he also pops up as himself in Joe Dante's Gremlins 2, which we talked about a lot when we had that conversation on Zoom. This was an absolute honour. Hope you enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Emperor Podcast by one of the most, I don't know how you're going to feel about this, Leonard, but I'm going to say it, one of the most legendary film critics of all time, the wonderful Leonard Maltin. How are you, sir?
Well, I'm flattered beyond description by that introduction. Thank you.
Do you think of yourself in such terms?
No. No, I'm a very lucky. I mean, I'm no false modesty here.
Yeah,
I've done a lot of things, and I've been very fortunate to be able to make a living doing something that I love, mm-hmm. writing and talking about movies and movie history, and I've had some success certainly in. And broadcasting as well as do you call podcasting broadcasting? I don't know if we even use that term anymore. Yeah. And publishing and I'm very proud of what I've done, but legendary starts to feel a little dicey.
Okay. Well, we'll take but it from
I'll
me. From
it.
The, absolutely.
It.
Well, from the outside looking in, certainly as a much lesser film critic, you know, it's people like yourself, it's Roger Ebert, Pauline Kael, of course, who I think when you're growing up, trying to break into this business, that you know you're kind of almost the North Stars in a way. It's fascinating because your career is extraordinary. I nearly introduced you as the star of Gremlins 2, but I decided to focus on the work instead.
Do you know that I still receive residual checks from Screen Actors Guild for that film, which continues to play around the globe? The checks now are down to something like $11.22. And of course, I never did it for the money. In the first place, but it is a constant reminder. I'm also on two TOPS, T-O-P-P-S, collector cards that tell the story of Gremlins 2. And as I told the director, Joe Dante, that is my ticket to immortality.
Well, there you go. Leonard, legendary. Not many film critics are on two TOPS trading cards.
That's true. That's true. But then I'm also perhaps, and I'm not certain of this, but perhaps the first working film critic to
work and do my reviews at a major movie studio. I was headquartered at Paramount Pictures for 24 years, working for the TV show Entertainment Tonight.
Yes.
So I was in the cauldron.
That's amazing. That is amazing. There's a lot to talk about with your life and career. Apologies if I feel fixated on Gremlins 2, but I adore that movie. And in some ways, it may have been my introduction to you,
mm-hmm.
seeing you pop up in that film whenever it first came out. How did it come about for you?
Well, Joe Dante, the director of that film, and the original Gremlins, of course,
mm-hmm.
Was somebody that I knew that I first met when we were both teenagers. I was growing up in a suburb of New York City. I was born in Manhattan, grew up mostly in the suburbs in New Jersey. And he grew up in South Jersey, I think, outside of Philadelphia. And we ran into each other in New York City, where we were both casting about and finding our way, watching revival screenings of old films and such. And he was writing wonderfully pithy reviews for Castle of Frankenstein magazine, a great journal edited by almost a Dickensian character named Calvin Beck.
Right.
About whom many stories could be told, but no one would want to hear them. Anyway, so Joe and I, we were never close friends, but we were acquaintances as far back as that. And when he came west, there was an exodus of people coming out to Los Angeles to work for Roger Corman in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
A mutual friend, John Davison, came first, and then John recommended that his friend Jonathan Kaplan be hired by Corman to take the place of Martin Scorsese, who didn't want to do a second movie for Roger Corman. He did direct Boxcar Bertha with Barbara Hershey. Yes. And he didn't disdain the experience, but he wanted to move on and do his own thing. So Scorsese said, call Jonathan Kaplan. He's very talented. And apparently Jonathan got a phone call from Corman, the legendary B-movie maestro,
yeah.
And who said, Marty Scorsese speaks very highly of you. So I've booked you on a plane from JFK tomorrow, and we start shooting Monday. on a film that he had prepared, scripted, cast. And then John and Jonathan Kaplan recommended their friend Joe Dante to come out and follow him. And Joe became the editor of all the trailers for New World Pictures.
Yes.
Those included the films that Corman acquired for U.S. distribution, like Fellini's Amarcord. And other prestigious foreign films. And then they called for their friend Alan Arkush, and Alan and Joe Dante co-directed Rock and Roll High School, then Fade Out and Fade In into the 1980s.
Uh-huh.
And I get hired, I get hired by a new TV show called Entertainment Tonight, which is a half hour every night. Entertainment news, which many people said, how can you fill a half hour with that? There's nothing like it on the air. And it took a little while to find its footing. And toward the end of the first season, they hired me after seeing me on the Today Show, which is then and now a very popular network, coast-to-coast morning chat show, where I was plugging a book that I'd written. And they hired me as their film critic. And to make a very long story very short, I stayed there 30 years.
Uh-huh.
But toward the beginning of its run, it was white hot. It was a really popular show. And I had the tricky, dicey assignment of reviewing a film called Gremlins, made by my old pal Joe Dante, and I didn't like the film. He filled it with in-jokes for all his film buff friends, mm-hmm. and I just, which I liked, which I enjoyed, but I thought the film had was kind of mean-spirited. Mm-hmm. And if I'd been on a newspaper staff, I would have recused myself from reviewing that movie. But I was the only film critic at Entertainment Tonight, yeah. and I had to go on. And I debated, should I soft pedal my feelings? Should I, you know, try to hide my reaction to the film? And I figured, no, I can't do that. Then I lose my credibility. So I said what I thought about the movie, and it caused a kind of a rift between us, which I fully understand. Who likes to be criticized, right? I don't like to be criticized.
Yeah.
But it caused a little rift, and a couple of years went by, and then his producing partner, Mike Fennell, called me and said, well, we're doing a sequel, Gremlins 2, where the Gremlins invade a TV network. And one of the shows they come in and disrupt is a movie review show. And we'd like you to be the movie reviewer. And I said, well, I think I owe you that much. So I found myself on a soundstage at Warner Brothers, holding a cassette of Gremlins in my hand. And Joe said, just use your own words. So he directed me to give a bad review to his first movie in the sequel. It's a unique situation.
Were you worried at all that it might be an elaborate trap?
No. No.
Okay.
But I was amusingly dispatched by the Gremlins.
you certainly were.
And then the executive producer of the film, none other than Steven Spielberg, said he wanted to use it as the trailer for the movie. And I said no, because I felt if we're going to do it, it should be a surprise. It should come as a surprise in the film.
Rightly so. So two questions about that, Leonard. Have your views on Gremlins, the first one, softened over the years?
No.
And they haven't. Okay.
No.
Have you revisited it, the first movie?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So are you very much a...
In other words, I've left it alone.
You've left it alone.
And Joe and I are friends again.
Okay, that's good. I'm glad to hear there's a happy ending. But does that mean, obviously, you have movies you love? Do you revisit movies often? Because there are so many movies. Or do you find you're very much a one-and-done person, for the most part, with films?
Well, I would say I'm pretty much a one-and-done person until recently, mm-hmm. when I started doing I host a podcast with my daughter, mm-hmm. A weekly interview podcast called Malton on Movies. Mm-hmm. I've for the past some months now, I've been doing another one called Movie Guide, the Movie Guide,
yeah,
with an Aussie named Guy Davis, and we have fun every week revisiting films of the past few decades, and this has impelled me to go back and see films that I wouldn't otherwise do. It's films I remember, but I have to refresh my memory, mm-hmm. talk about them intelligently, and it's fun. So now I am doing that, and it's been a really a very positive experience.
But Gremlins, you would not go back and revisit?
Well, it's not one that I would race to do, no.
Okay, fair enough. And what's the movie that has surprised you most in terms of your memories of it, positive or negative, and then revisiting it and whether it had changed a lot?
Everything that I've seen so far has lived up to my memory. The original Jurassic Park, the original, well, Jaws. What else have we done? There's a Terminator. Mm-hmm. I should have a list in front of me, but I don't. But films of the 70s, 80s, 90s, and aughts, they've all held up quite well.
Let's take you back to the beginning. How did this start for you?
Well, I never had any ambitions to be a critic. My great interest was and remains film history. Mm-hmm. So as a kid, I fell in love with Charlie Chaplin, and then you know Buster Keaton, and then Laurel and Hardy, and all silent films really got me into this. And so I was primarily interested in learning everything I could, gobbling up everything I could about the not just the past, but the personalities and the why-fors and wherefores of how films came to be. When I was in college, I wrote my first. I went to New York University and worked on a daily newspaper there. Mm-hmm. That's when I wrote my first real reviews. And my role model was the man who is mostly disparaged in modern times, the New York Times longtime critic Bosley Crowther.
Oh yes,
who was if he's known at all today, he's known for being the man who vilified Bonnie and Clyde, one of the game-changing movies of the New Hollywood, and then doubled down and re-reviewed it, and killed his own reputation in the process. Yeah. But he was my folks subscribed to the New York Times. It was delivered to our doorstep every morning in Teaneck, New Jersey, and so he was the one I read. Then I started reading others, you know, as I grew and matured.
And who was a big influence on you in terms of your writing style?
He was. Well, I mean, my style bears no resemblance to his, but he sort of gave me a template for this is what a movie review looks like and reads like.
We should say you have a new book out.
Yes, I do.
It's called Every Movie is a Miracle, and it is an absolute delight. And it's a conversation between yourself and Nat Segalov. How did it come about for you?
There is a boutique publisher called The Sticking Place. Mm-hmm. It's a Shakespearean reference. And he approached me, as he has approached a number of not veteran, but one of them, mature people who've written about film over the recent decades to come up with ideas for books. And these books are printed on demand. So it's an unusual situation. Mm-hmm. Where you know, I don't expect to see this book on any bestseller lists anytime soon, but I hope it finds an audience. I've gotten nice response to it. My old friend Nat Segalov, who's an incredibly prolific writer of books about film and film people, most recently a book about the collaboration between Humphrey Bogart and John Huston, for instance.
Wow.
Really interesting book. Anyway, Nat and I have known each other for some 40 years. And so it's a long conversation between him and me about my life and work and experiences. And I've had a lot of colorful experiences with everybody from Buster Keaton to Katharine Hepburn to, you know, I drop names all day. and that's what it is.
The title, Leonard, Every Movie is a Miracle. Can you talk about that? Is that something that you believe?
It was said to me by my old friend John Davison. I should explain this in the book, and I don't. But he laid it on the line. He said that a movie gets made is miraculous because there's so many stumbling blocks. There's so many hindrances to getting a movie made, let alone seen. Distributed, reviewed, all the steps down the line. But just making a movie is an incredible achievement. And I found that to be true. So in a way, every movie is a miracle.
Even Gremlins.
even Gremlins, which is about to be remade.
It is. Although they said it's Gremlins 3. I don't know whether that's, who knows, but yeah. there'll be Gremlins in the works all over the place. I meant to ask you this question about 15 minutes ago, and I got distracted, as is my wont. Did you review Gremlins 2 in the end, or did you recuse yourself from that?
No, I did review it. I have a review that stands in the movie guide. Mm-hmm. Where it mentions I can't remember the adjective I used, sort of fatuous cameo appearances, something like that.
Leonard, I've got to go in a couple of seconds, but as you say, you can drop some names, sir. You mentioned Buster Keaton. What was your run-in with Buster Keaton like?
This is amazing. I wouldn't believe it if I hadn't experienced it. As I said, I grew up in the New York suburbs, and every morning the New York Times was on the doorstep. So I, my best friend and I were going to go into the city for the day to do as we often did. We went to, there used to be a street called Book Row, mm-hmm. or colloquially called Book Row, or used bookshops, where we would find at affordable prices to a couple of kids, books that we wanted to buy, and or we would go to the Museum of Modern Art and watch an old movie. And this day, before we left, I was looking at the Times, and there was a story with a photo about Buster Keaton shooting a film with the playwright Samuel Beckett. And as it said in the article, in alongside a dilapidated warehouse in the shadow of the Brooklyn Bridge. I said to my friend Lewis, we got to go. This is our golden opportunity. And I had just bought a still, an 8x10 still of Buster Keaton. I didn't know what it was from, but it cost me all of 25 cents. And, the local used bookstore.
Yeah.
So I put them in an envelope, and we took the subway downtown to Canal Street and emerged to the street level. And there are a lot of buildings that have been bulldozed. And so we could see about three blocks away, we could see some reflectors, big lights and reflectors. And we walked mm-hmm. over there. And as we approached, we saw that sitting in the back seat of a car, with his pork pie hat on the seat next to him, was Buster Keaton. No security, no, guards, no. So I sort of poked my head in the backseat window and said, excuse me, Mr. Keaton? He said, yeah. I said, my name's Leonard Balton, blah, 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 blah. Big fan, blah, 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 blah. And I found this still, but I don't know what it's from. Perhaps you can tell me. I handed him the still, and he said, well, that's some parlor, bedroom, and bath. Said, but that's not the gal I did the scene with. This must have been a rehearsal. I said, would you mind signing it? No, he signed it, Buster Keaton. And then really we didn't, he was not a talkative person, as I later learned, certainly not with strangers
mm-hmm.
and or kids. And yeah. So we had our moment with him, and then we sort of gracefully backed away and met Buster Keaton. I mean, that's what happened.
Oh, my God.
And a year later, we saw that film in its debut showing at the New York Film Festival, Lincoln Center. It's an odd film. He didn't understand what it was about. Neither did we once we saw it. And in that year's time, he passed away.
Oh.
So we had, it was just a wonderful bit of serendipity that I can say I met Buster Keaton.
That is incredible. And you were what, 14, 15 at the time?
13 years old.
Wow.
That same year I wrote a combination Get Well and fan letter to Stan Laurel. And he sent me back a nice note on he had photo postcards printed up because he answered all his fan, diligently answered all his fan mail, and said, hello, Leonard, and good luck. And and it's hanging on my wall, framed as it was the day I got it. Oh, this is my granddaughter, my four-year-old granddaughter.
Oh, bless. Leonard, there's just one last thing, if you don't mind, real quick. I was really struck in the book. You document your experiences with Tommy Lee Jones. Those are three words that strike fear into the hearts of interviewers. In your book, you talk about how you had some success and even struck up something of a cordial relationship with him. But
cordial is over.
Okay, cordial may be my word, not yours.
He tolerates.
What was your secret? How do you interview the uninterviewable?
Being bullheaded, diligence, refusing to go away. I interviewed him on location for a film called Volcano.
Yes.
And they were shooting at MacArthur Park, which is a downtown Los Angeles and a neighborhood you don't want to be in. And when I finished, he was wrapped for the day on the movie, and he changed into his street clothes. And so he left us for a moment, and then he was leaving the premises, and I was interviewing one of his co-stars, and he took a moment to stop and sort of pat me on the back, said, "Nice to talk to you." And our sound man from Entertainment Tonight said, "As long as that guy's a star, you have a job."
That's amazing. And then you ran into each other over the years.
Oh yeah. I mean, I interviewed him on a press junket for John Grisham film, I think The Firm, and a action film called Blown Away with Jeff Bridges, where he played the bad guy. And at the end of a rather strained interview, the publicist said to me, "Boy, you got the best interview all day." It's just bullheadedness. I asked if he enjoyed playing a villain. I said, there's a lot of actors say that they much prefer to playing heroes because they're more colorful characters. And he said, "Well, yeah, that's true. Yeah. In fact, I'd say that's stating the obvious." And I said, "Well, we specialize in that at Entertainment Tonight." And he didn't laugh. He didn't smile, but he accepted that as a response. Most recently, I interviewed him at the Telluride Film Festival, where he debuted a film he directed called The Homesman.
Yes.
Which hasn't had much of a life because it's a very, very downbeat film.
Yes.
Challenging movie to watch. But I thought a good one. I was there sort of not so much as an interviewer, but as a co-host of the screening, you might say.
Yes.
He was just as standoffish as ever. My daughter asked to take a picture of us together, and we are standing next to each other. I was like, "Yet there's still 3 feet of air between us."
Well, Leonard, you're a braver man than I. It's all I can say. You've talked to Tommy Lee Jones and lived to tell the tale. That's amazing. It's been an absolute pleasure. Leonard Moulton, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for a lovely chat.
There you go, folks. That was a lovely chat with Leonard Moulton. And as he mentioned, Every Movie is a Miracle, which is excellent, is produced according to demand. You can find copies over here in various good and evil bookstores and online as well at the usual suspects. But maybe you should just screw your courage to the sticking place and head to stickingplacebooks.com, where you will find Every Movie is a Miracle and many other film books that may be of interest. Oh, and you can find out more about Leonard Moulton and his incredible career at leonardmoulton.com. And on that note, that is it for this edition of The Interviews. We will be back next week with more cracking guests, and over on the main Empire podcast show, which will be up imminently, not only will you have Team Empire, including me, having all kinds of film-related fun, but you'll have one more interview to listen to with the Oscar-nominated star of The Secret Agent, Wagner Moura, and his director, Kleber Mondonca Filho. Okay, that is enough for me. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.